Well, Hare Krishna, everybody. Thank you for coming. Some of you may not know me because I don't come here very often on Sundays. Is anybody new here? You know? Oh, where have you come from? Washington, D.C. Well, welcome here to ISV. What's your name? Jadarani. And you can play the kartals. And are you just visiting here? Oh, what's the conference? Oh, I see. Well, how long will you be here for? Oh, well, I'm glad at least you could come for today. Have you seen Vaisheshika Prabhu? When he comes to Washington? Uh-huh, right. Oh, great. Yeah, he was just there a month ago. And normally he'd be here giving the talk on Sundays, but he's on a book marathon. He's writing a book on book distribution in Sankirtan. I've talked to him a couple of times during the week, and he's Mr. Focus, right? Yeah, I mean, he's able to motivate himself to sit down and write every day and not hold back, you know, get into the details of whatever he's doing. So I thought we'd read from the Bhagavad Gita today. But before that, I just want to offer prayers to our spiritual master and all of our spiritual masters, all the way back to Lord Krishna. And you'll find these prayers in the Bhagavad Gita, right after the end, or is it before the introduction?
It's in the introduction.
In the introduction.
Page one.
Oh, yes. I can't see with my glasses on, I can't see with them off. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Yena Tasmain Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupagadamayam Tadate Swabhadantekam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Parakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Prijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakavitamscha Namhe Krishna Karna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gorange Radhe Vrindavanishvare Rishavanu Suti Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Pititanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Garadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktarinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I'd like to read one of my favorite verses from the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, all of us have many, many favorite verses, right? What's your favorite verse? Manmana Bhavamana Bhakto? 1865? Okay. Nice. Do you have a favorite verse, Raksha? Aye. You have a favorite verse? Anybody else have a favorite verse? Oh, nice. Yeah, Krishna's easily pleased with a little love and devotion. Huh? The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Jagat Ishwara, is pleased with a little offering of water. Well, I guess I'm a Gyani at heart. Because I love chapter 13. And it's all about the soul and the super soul. But I wanted to read from 1334. It's next to the last verse of the chapter. And I like this verse because It's one of those verses where, they're all... It's not dogma. It's just a direct explanation of how one can perceive the soul. And it's applicable to any person who's interested in self-realization. There's nothing to argue about. So we'll read the Sanskrit and then the word for word and then the purport. So just try and follow after me. Actually, I haven't memorized this verse yet, but I sort of know the words. Yata prakasayati eka. Yata prakasayati eka. Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Kshetram kshetri yata. Krishnam kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam. Prakasayati Bharata. Prakasayati Bharata. Yata prakasayat yeka. Yata prakasayat yeka. Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam. Kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam. Prakasayati Bharata. Prakasayati Bharata. Yata prakasayat yeka. Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam. Prakasayati Bharata. Yata prakasayat yeka. Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam. Prakasayati Bharata. Any takers? Yata prakasayat yeka. Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam.
Kshetram kshetri tata Krishnam.
Prakashayati Bharata.
Yatha prakashayatyeka.
Prakashayatyeka.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi. Kshetram kshetri tatha krishnam.
Kshetram kshetri tatha krishnam.
Prakashayati Bharata.
Yata prakashayati ka.
Yata prakashayati ka.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Kshetram kshetri tatha krishnam.
Kshetram kshetri tatha krishnam.
Prakashayati Bharata.
Prakashayati Bharata. Yata prakashayati ka.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Kshetram Kshetri Tatha Krishnam.
Kshetram Kshetri Tatha Krishnam.
Prakashayati Bharatam.
Prakashayati Bharatam. Yata Prakashayatekam. Krishnam Lokam Iram Ravi. Kshetram Kshetri Yata Krishnam. Prakasayati Bharata. Yata Prakasayati Ka. Krishna Lokam Imam Ravi. Kshetram Kshetri Yata Krishnam. Prakasadyati Bharata. That's good. Is it clicked all the way up? Okay.
Hello. Yatha prakasayati eka.
Yatha prakasayati eka.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Krishnam lokam imam ravi.
Kshetram kshetri tatha krishnam.
Kshetram kshetri yatha krishnam.
Prakasayati bharata.
Prakasayati bharata. Very good. You're all very brave. All right, let's read the word for word. Yata, as, prakasayati, illuminates, eka, one, kritsnam, the whole, lokam, universe, imam, this, ravi, sun, Kshetram, this body. Kshetri, the soul. So Kshetri is the one who has the Kshetra. It's possessive. Tata, similarly. Kritsnam, all. Prakasayati, illuminates. Bharata, O son of Bharata. So, Lord Krishna says to Arjuna, O son of Bharata, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. Please repeat. O son of Bharata, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe. So does the living entity. One within the body. Illuminate the entire body by consciousness. Purport. By Srila Prabhupada. There are various theories regarding consciousness. Here in Bhagavad Gita, the example of the sun and the sunshine is given. As the sun is situated in one place, but is illuminating the whole universe, so a small particle of spirit soul, although situated in the heart of this body, is illuminating the whole body by consciousness. Thus, the consciousness is the proof of the presence of the soul, as sunshine or light is the proof of the presence of the sun. When the soul is present in the body, there is consciousness all over the body. And as soon as the soul has passed from the body, there is no more consciousness. This can be easily understood by any intelligent man. Therefore, consciousness is not a product of the combinations of matter. It is the symptom of the living entity. The consciousness of the living entity, although qualitatively one with the supreme consciousness, is not supreme because the consciousness of one particular body does not share that of another body. But the supersoul, which is situated in all bodies as the friend of the individual soul, is conscious of all bodies. That is the difference between supreme consciousness and individual consciousness. So, profound subject matter. Prabhupada starts out by saying there's various theories regarding consciousness. Of course, material science, I don't know so much today, but and especially when I was young, it was pretty much common in school that according to science, consciousness was a combination of chemical reactions within brain cells. Of course, it's a theory and it can't be proven. And now with the advance of science and also with the advance of medical science, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest just the opposite, that consciousness exists independent of the material body, that the material body exists because of consciousness, not the other way around. You know, there's many documented experiences of those who have been under surgery. There are certain surgeries, even when they do a coronary bypass graft, I think generally they stop the heart. They through an artificial heart, they pump blood through the body. The heart is stopped. And there are some surgeries, I think they used to perform in Russia, I'm not sure if they still do, where, maybe you know this rock shit, but they cool the body down, not to freezing, but to where the cellular activity will become very, very slow. And they stop the heart. And so at that time, there is no blood flow in the body, and there's no electrical activity in the brain. So technically speaking, the person is dead. And they can keep this body and keep the person kind of in a suspended state for hours, as long as they keep the temperature down at a certain point. And then they warm up the body again after they've done the surgery and fill the body with blood again and start the heart and wake the person up. So there's lots of a lot of times during these surgeries or during these situations where people have technically died, they have out-of-body experiences and they're fully awake and they're able to tell the surgeons, you know, like what nonsense they were discussing during the surgery and what kind of jokes they were making about the person's body. And, you know, because they say some pretty horrible things sometimes. I even used to have patients that a lot of times patients appear to be unconscious, or they are unconscious, but they can still hear. But they cannot see, they cannot speak, they can't do anything else. So it looks like they're unconscious, but actually they're still hearing and they're still comprehending things. I used to have a lot of patients like that that later, when they woke up, told me things they heard us talking about. And we are actually trained to be careful what we say around unconscious patients because they actually still may be hearing, because that's the last sense to go. Anyway, my point is that in medical science today, there is a lot of, you can't prove it beyond, according to the scientific method, that consciousness is independent of the life of the body. But there is a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that. And Prabhupada makes the point here in the purport that it's very fundamental. You know, when consciousness is in the body, it's alive. And when consciousness has left the body, then it's dead. And therefore, it's not due to chemical combination. He inferred that. Because all the chemicals are still there. So therefore, why has life disappeared from the body? And only a person in extreme denial is not able to recognize that. So sometimes a loved one dies, right, before our eyes, and people cannot accept it. The loved ones cannot accept it because they're in a state of denial. That's part of the grieving process. But others who are not attached, they can see, oh yes, the consciousness has left the body. One time I had a call. I used to work on an ambulance, for all of those you who don't know me. And I had a call. There was these two Chinese women, and they'd called the ambulance for their mother. And they called 911, and they said the mother is very, very cold. They didn't say she died or anything. They just said she's very cold, and we want someone to come, you know, see how she is. So it didn't sound like a very, very serious call, right? So they can only tell on the telephone from the reports from the people who call if it's serious or not. And so we didn't go there with lights and sirens. We just went up there kind of nonchalant, and we saw that there were these two middle-aged Chinese women, and they were massaging this elderly Chinese woman who was laying on the floor. And what they were doing was they were covering her body with Tiger Balm. You know what Tiger Balm is? You know, like it's like liquid heat when you have sore muscles. Menthol. It creates a lot of heat, right? So her body, the grandmother's body was very, very cold, so they were putting Tiger Balm on her. Well, the reason she was cold is because her spirit soul had left the body. She was dead. So as long as the soul is in the body, then the cells are alive and they're creating heat. And as soon as the soul leaves the body, then immediately the body's temperature begins to decrease. And in fact, oftentimes that's how the coroner will determine the time of death. They'll calculate the ambient temperature, and then they'll calculate the temperature in the liver. They'll stick a thermometer into the liver, and then they'll calculate that you lose like, I don't know how many degrees an hour the liver will lose heat. So like if the liver is 76 degrees and the ambient temperature is like 70 degrees, they'll say that, you know, that the person's been dead like 6 hours or something like that. Actually, when bodies are even covered, what to speak if they have an electric blanket on, they'll stay warm for quite a while, even though the person's been dead. Anyway, my point is that the real determining factor of whether a person is alive or dead is if there's consciousness in the body. And Krishna is actually showing us here how we can have a direct experience of the soul in the body. I mean, it's so fundamental that we don't even notice it. And in fact, if we're very, very distracted, we can't even perceive it. But Krishna is giving the example here. He says that just as the sun illuminates the whole universe, the spirit's soul illuminates the body with consciousness. So we can't see the sun today, can we? It's very cloudy out. But still it's light. So we know that it's not dark yet. If we had no clocks right now, if you didn't look at a clock, what time would you guess it was just by looking outside? It's a cloudy day. And just by looking outside right now, it's really hard to tell. It could be 4 o'clock. The days are getting longer. It could be 6 o'clock. It could be 2 o'clock. Because when it's cloudy, it's relatively dark, but there's still light. Anyway, we know the sun is there. So similarly, we know the soul is in the body because of consciousness. And that consciousness is directly perceived by the soul itself. When consciousness is directed inside, because consciousness is the only thing that perceives, it's the perceiving quality. It's the awareness. That is consciousness. Consciousness, awareness, there's no difference. And so whatever the consciousness is, the perceiving principle. So when consciousness is directed back in, it can perceive itself. When consciousness is directed outside through the senses, then mind arises and sense perception arises and consciousness is distracted so that it doesn't perceive itself, so it feels like it's separate. It doesn't sense its eternal Satchitananda quality, eternity, knowledge and bliss, which is the essential qualities of the soul. And the soul is never separate from the Supreme Soul or from other souls, for that matter. That sense of separateness arises due to the mind, due to identification with the mind. And so as long as one is identified with the mind, even though you could say the soul is right in front of your face, you can't see it if you're identified with the mind and you're looking outside. So the whole yoga process is to calm down the mind and to direct the consciousness back within. It's the whole yoga theory. And sometimes the example is given of a lake, that consciousness will be the bottom, of the lake. And if the water is still, if you look in through the water, you can see the bottom. But if the water is moving around and if it's agitated, you can't see the bottom. And so if the mind is very, very busy, then it's difficult for the soul to look within and see itself. But if the mind is a little bit calmed, then the soul can perceive itself. Lord Chaitanya said, Cheto Darpana Marjanam. He compared the mind to a mirror, right? And he says if that mirror is dusty, if you look into a dusty mirror, you won't see your image. You'll see some perverted reflection. But if you have a clean mirror and you look into it, then you'll actually see yourself. So as the mirror of the heart becomes cleansed, the yogi, the bhakti yogi, begins to perceive his spiritual nature, which is Satchitananda and bliss and form, with form too, Satchitananda Vigraha. But first, there will be a perception of peace, of connectedness, of eternality. There won't be any fear. We fear, ultimately, our fear is about death. Every other fear, even when two people are having an argument with each other about who's right and who's wrong. For somebody who has a very, very big false ego, to be wrong is almost like dying. People will kill each other over who's right and who's wrong. Because the ego is very afraid of death, ultimately. That's the underlying motivating force there. So, as one begins to perceive the self, there's a certainty of one's eternality that is there, already known within the soul, so there's no more fear of death. And there's no sense of separation because it's seen that all the spirit souls are the same and they're connected with the Supreme Soul. So there's not this sense of other or you know, enemy or someone to be afraid of and someone to be different from. So Krishna's suggesting here that consciousness can be perceived within the body, and this is not this perception of consciousness in the body is not the body itself. It's actually direct perception of the soul. So, like, if you're feeling your hands, I mean, you can just, if you can focus enough to put your attention on your hands, can everyone do that right now? And can you just put your attention on your hands and feel them? It takes a little bit of concentration, but with just a little concentration, you can feel your hands, right? And so what you're thinking is what I'm feeling is my hands, but actually what you're experiencing is consciousness. There's consciousness in the hands. And that's directly the soul. And it's direct. There's no mind at that point. Now, if you think, you know, I have five fingers and my hands feel warm, and you start having thoughts, then the mind has gotten involved. But just the direct perception of the hand itself is just the soul there in the hands. It's consciousness. It's the awareness. Just like if you're looking at my face, right? There's no effort. It doesn't require any effort to see. It doesn't require any effort to hear the kids outside. Right? Now, if you start thinking, oh, those are kids' voices, then the mind has gotten involved. But the direct perception itself is just consciousness. And the consciousness of hearing or the consciousness of seeing. So when the mind slows down a little bit, you can have this direct perception or you can practice it. Actually, to become more and more aware of the spirit soul, we have to become freed of the identification with the mind. And really, that's not such a difficult thing if one practices it. Of course, we do this when we're practicing japa. So this is those who practice japa gradually get this realization, even if no one tells them about it. But the thing is that if you can begin to become free of identification with the mind by learning how to watch the mind. And or you could say, if you take time to notice the voice in your head, right? Usually we have a dialogue going on inside the head, right? Sometimes we can have multiple dialogues. You know, there's a commentary going on about the kids and commentary going on, why I wonder what prasadam's going to be like today, and so many things. Sometimes we have commentaries about ourselves going on as well, and then we have a commentary about the commentator. And so these are all voices going on in the head. So you can actually intentionally observe that voice and become the witnessing presence. So another word for consciousness is presence, the witnessing presence. So if you watch, if you listen to the dialogue that's going on in your mind with the intention to observe it and not to judge it. See, if you make a judgment about it, then you could say that the mind has come in again through the back door. Because as soon as there's judgment, then there's, again, identification with the thought. But if you're just observing the thought without judgment, without being critical, then what happens is that you notice that there's the thought, and then there's the witnessing presence of the thought. And that witnessing presence is I am. So there's an I am realization. There's an I am awareness that is not from the mind, that arises from beyond the mind, you know. And that becomes apparent when you're watching the mind. But when there's identification with the mind, then that deeper sense of I am gets obscured by the thoughts and the identification with the thoughts. But as soon as there's that awareness of I am and there's the watching of the thought, that breaks the identification with the thought, and therefore then the thought begins to dissipate. And then there's a gap of no thought, or in Buddhism it's called no mind. The mind is always there, but it's just empty. There's no thought, there's a little gap there. And there's that sense of presence. And in that sense of presence is the peace of eternality, is the certainty of eternality, and the joy of being, the joy of consciousness. And so if we slow our mind down a little bit, like what happens when you chant japa, and you intentionally focus your attention upon the consciousness that's pervading the body, this presence and joy increases. And then you'll see gaps of no thought. There's just the Hare Krishna mantra and the person present there listening to it. And the Hare Krishna mantra and Krishna are non-different. Nama Chintamani Krishnas Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha Purna Sudo Nitya Mukto Vinatvam Naminamino. That's from the Padma Purana. It says that Krishna and his name are non-different. In other words, the name and the named are the same. And that name is Purna. It's full, it's eternal, it's non-dual, and it's everlasting. And so we have a sense of our presence as we're observing the mind, we're chanting the mantra, we're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And so there's this deeper sense of self, deeper sense of presence. And then we're chanting the name of the source of our presence. And so there's a connection, there's a relationship that's not about the mind. You know, we can sit and think in pictures and imagine this and that, but the mind itself and the thoughts they're dull, they're dead really. It's dead matter, and it's not, has nothing to do with the self. But when one is turn the awareness back in and experiencing the presence of self and feeling the relationship with the super self, who is non-different than the Hare Krishna mantra, then there's an establishment of the relationship with the Supreme through direct experience, with no mind needing to be involved. But when identification with the mind is there, this is very difficult to perceive. So therefore, Krishna is giving us a nice example how we can perceive the soul within the body. But in order to have that perception, one has to learn how to turn the awareness inside, as Krishna is suggesting actually in this verse. With just a little bit of practice, one can just intentionally observe, observe the thinker. It's called watching the thinker. So you can practice this, during the week maybe, and just notice with intention and without judgment, just notice the dialogue that's going on inside there. And don't comment on it. Don't judge it. Because if you do, then there's already, then you're thinking about the thinking. Right, and you become identified with it. So if you don't judge it, it can be totally, you're right, outrageous things maybe going on in there. But you passively, non-judgmentally watch it, then there'll be a gap, then there'll be that sense of presence. There'll be that sense that there's something else, a higher level of consciousness has come in. There's the watcher, there's the presence of the thought. And then there'll be that sense of self. It's not something you think about. It's an inner knowingness that's there within the soul that awakens as one becomes to notice that he's the witnessing presence of the mind and not the mind. And then you can go through this exercise. I think we did this in the japa seminar, one of them, where did we talk about. We did some breathing exercises, and then I said, notice the feeling in your hands. If your mind is thinking, 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 and there's a lot of distractions, that's hard to do. But if you're calmed down a little bit, it's easy to focus and feel the energy in your hands, I think. And that's direct. Then you feel it in your feet. Then you feel it, you know, like in your abdomen area. And then you feel it in the whole body with your breathing. And then if you can, chant in that state of being aware of your presence within the body. And then feeling the connection with the person's name that you're chanting, who's the source of your awareness. If you're aware of your awareness, then you'll have more appreciation for the source, naturally, of your awareness. It's just a natural result.
You were mentioning about focusing on the eye. That is, one go through a stage where one is focused on the eye. Is that, what is that eye? Is that different from the soul?
It is the soul, but it's not a thought. It's actually, it's a feeling of aliveness. Like you can feel the aliveness in your hands, right? And there's no thought required. And when you're watching the mind, you're watching the thought, simultaneously there's a sense of the watcher, there's a sense of your presence. That's not a thought, it's before the mind. And we're thinking we need the mind for that, but we don't. It's before the mind, and with a little practice you begin to notice that. And then you try and maintain that as you chant Krishna's name. And so it's a sense of presence. You know, when you're witnessing the thought, there'll be a note, you'll notice there's the thought, but simultaneously you'll notice you're the one watching the thought. But you won't be thinking that, you'll be feeling it. Because ultimately we're about feeling more than we are about thinking. The soul is perception, it is awareness, which is feeling.
And that is different from the ego, because there is some entity called the ego.
Yeah. Well, we have the false ego and then we have the real ego. So it's the beginning of awareness of the real sense of self. We're identified with the mind, so we're thinking our thoughts are me. So that's the false ego. Right? And therefore we give our thoughts a lot of importance. Whatever we're thinking, we think is really meaningful. You know? And whatever we remember about the past, there's this sense that it's about me, right? You have a little memory, you have a memory of when you were a small child, right? Or when you graduated from high school, or when you graduated from the university. And those good thoughts are really, really important to us, right? We hold on to them like, that's me, right? But how long will that be me? Till you leave this body. And then all of that means nothing. And actually, it, even right now, it means nothing. But it only means something because we give it importance. That's the ego, the false ego. Now, for a devotee, what I've suggested here is a little disconcerting, maybe. Because you can start to see what you're not, but it's not too apparent yet what you are. So there's this a tendency to think, well, if I let go of the mind, will I become a Mayavadi? Will I be an impersonalist? Since I don't have a real perception of what I am besides just presence, you know, what's my relationship with Krishna? You know, I want to know that, you know, and that's the ultimate ego. But it's simultaneously one and different, you know. Simultaneously, we're one with each other. There actually is no difference, and there is no separation. Yet, as Prabhupada mentions here in the purport, I know what's going on in this body, and you don't, and you know what's going on in your body, and I don't. So the soul is simultaneously one and different. Mamai vamso jiva loke. Jiva bhuta sanatanam. Krishna says that the jiva bhutas, they're eternally my separated parts and parcels. So Krishna has expanded himself as the jivas separately, but in quality, qualitatively, we're one, and there is no separation. But experientially, you know, I have my point of experience, and you have your point of experience, and we're identified with this body, so it appears to be some difference. So, and in the beginnings of realization, the first thing is to perceive that you're not the mind, and to let that go, because that obscures the perception of the soul. And that's where the ego is. And the ego actually doesn't exist in the present moment, because the mind only exists in the past and the future. In the present moment, there's only awareness, and there is no thinking, there is no mind. The mind arises with the thoughts. And then the identification with those thoughts is me, and we put all our attention there. So when you begin to watch the thoughts, then that's the death of the ego, basically, the false ego. But the real ego, Jiva Swarupaya Krishnara Nitya Das, Krishna said, he was asked, you know, by Sanatana Goswami, what is the self? And Lord Chaitanya replied, Jiva Swarup Krishnara Nitya Das, the jiva, the eternal identity of the jiva, is an eternal servant of Krishna. But we're not so aware of that, completely aware of it. Although, mentally, we may be aware of it. So when we first let go of the mind and when we first let go of the ego, it may be a little disconcerting because we're not so aware of what we are, but we're starting to be aware of what we're not. So when you experience presence, when you experience a sense of aliveness, even within the body, you can use the body to transcend the body just by focusing the awareness on that sense of aliveness. Because that is the self, it's not the body. It's just it's the self in the body, that's all. But that awareness, that aliveness, that's pure spirit soul. And so we put our attention there as opposed to into the mind. As soon as you start watching a thought and you notice that you're the watcher, then you're no longer feeding the mind and that thought begins to disappear. And as soon as there is identification with the thought, then the attention is feeding that thought and then the identification just gets stronger. So if you practice being the observer of the thought, then you're no longer feeding it, then there's that sense of aliveness, there's that sense of self beyond the mind, and then all the qualities of the self in that moment, Satchit Ananda, are observable, perceivable. And so that's the real ego, the real self. But it's, you know, what that self is in relationship to Krishna has not been revealed completely yet. You know, beyond the intellectual. But first we have to let go of the identification in order to have that perception. Otherwise it's obscured.
How is the intelligent mind the parts in this?
What's that?
How is the intelligent mind all the parts in this?
The intelligence? Well, the intelligence is... Mind and intelligence are... in some ways, almost interchangeable. It's, you could say that intelligence is the judging factor of the mind. But the intelligence wants to figure out the soul, right? It wants to figure out everything. But the soul is beyond the intelligence. So there's a verse in that. Let's look at verse 41, third chapter, where Krishna explains his hierarchy. Or maybe it's 42. Yes, 42. Page 188. You have it there, Dilip? Yeah. Indriyani paranyahur, indriyebhya paramana, manasastu parabuddhir, yobure paratastu saha. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind, and he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. So the way I like to conceive of it is if you're on the the top of a five-story building, right? You look over the side, and you can see the fourth floor, you can see the third floor, you can see the second floor, and you can see the first floor. Now, if you're on the first floor, and you look up, you really can't see what's up above. So, if you're looking, if you're aware of presence, like I've been suggesting, then you're observing the mind so you can see it, right? You're not in it, you're outside looking at it. And then you can see the intelligence is the discriminating factor of the mind. So you can even watch that doing its thing, you know, you can hear that dialogue. Well, what about this? What about that? You know, you can watch that all because you're the witnessing presence. Then you can also notice the sense perception, and then you can also notice the objects of the senses, which is dull matter, right? Because you're higher than all of that. So that's what Krishna is. He's pointing this out to Arjuna. He's saying, look, you're the soul, you know. You can look down and you can see all these things. So he's pointing it out. Then he says in the next verse exactly how to do that. He says, evam buddhe param buddhva samstab yapanamatmanaha jahi satyu mahabaho kamarupam durasadam. He's saying, thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, one should study the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence, Krishna consciousness, and thus, by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. So this verse is a little bit difficult to understand, but in the purport, it's made more clear, and there's one sentence there that Prabhupada says, what this means by deliberate spiritual intelligence means you should direct your awareness towards your pure identity. In other words, the pure identity is your spirit soul, your eternal servant of Krishna. That's the pure identity. So the first perception of that is you're noticing your presence, beginning to see the soul as separate from the mind and the body. And not by an intellectual exercise, but by your direct experience. Because intellectually, the intelligence cannot wrap its mind, it cannot wrap itself around the soul. Because the soul is higher than the intelligence. So the soul is directly perceived. The soul is the only thing that perceives. But whatever it perceives, it's identifying with, you know, through the false ego, and then it loses itself. So the trick is to pull back and begin to observe it. And in that state, you can directly perceive yourself. And so this is what Krishna is suggesting here in these verses, actually, to Arjuna, is how to do that.
This brings up a couple of questions. One is, who is actually doing it? And and the other is that you said that directing one's awareness to consciousness or the self is using spiritual intelligence. So then are we making a distinction between regular intelligence referred to in the previous verse, which is above the mind, and something called spiritual intelligence, just like you made a distinction between ordinary ego and real ego. So is spiritual intelligence then a quality of the soul or the self? And if that is acting, then is the soul or the self acting?
Okay, yeah, two questions. So when one is able to distinguish oneself from matter, that's spiritual intelligence. Seeing the difference between the mind and the self. In other words, when presence begins to observe thought, then there's it's called labdhabuddhi. It's an awakening of spiritual intelligence where one can clearly see the difference, the distinction between oneself and matter. So you could say that's spiritual intelligence. Now, you know, who's doing that? Krishna explains that actually the soul's not doing anything, ever. Just the mind and the modes of material nature are acting. And as long as one is identified with the mind, really, there's no opportunity to do anything. You know, you just have to follow the computer program. That's it. And so it's really not, it's not when as when the soul intentionally begins to wake up and observe, you know, itself, it's really not doing anything. It's just being what it is. You know, because awareness always is. It's just, it's sleeping in this condition. But it always is. And it can wake up when one is fortunate to meet a spiritually advanced person or read the Bhagavad Gita and get this instruction. If somebody tells you, finally, that you can, actually you don't have to be the mind anymore, you can just watch it, and you begin to do that, then you wake up. And as long as we want to sit in the movie and think we're the movie, then we'll stay in that, you know, kind of asleep state. Like we were mentioning before, that even when we're sleeping, consciousness is there. And it, you know, if we heard a noise, we'd wake up, because the consciousness is there to perceive the noise to wake up. You know, if consciousness wasn't there, there would be no waking up. So there's different levels of consciousness, and this is described, you know, in the Yoga Sutras. And actually, Keshava Bharti was saying that Jiva Goswami goes into great detail about levels of consciousness in the Sandarbhas. So there's unconsciousness, there's dreaming, or there's, you know, deep sleep or unconsciousness, dreaming. Then there's awake, but dreaming, like we are now. And then there's what's called Turiya, or the fourth dimension, where you become the you wake up to the point where you're the witness of your mind, and then you're in the fourth dimension, or you're in the liberated stage, because you're no longer in identification. And therefore, then you begin to sense Satchitananda, which is always there. So it's not like you're doing anything.
So when it is awake, it's not doing anything, but it is observing or perceiving.
Perceiving,
it, yeah, is witnessing.
Witnessing, yeah.
And so spiritual intelligence would have to be then the quality of the soul.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the soul has everything. The mind and the intelligence, the body, are actually all dead. All the pictures and all the thoughts that we're having, that we're thinking so important, and they actually have no substance and no life. They're only fed by this, by the attention that the self gives it. And it's very sticky, because the false ego is like right there immediately. Oh yes, this is me. Oh, it's so terrible. Oh, it's so nice. You know, back and forth. But Krishna's telling us here in this verse, you can observe yourself within the body, and you can use the body to transcend the body. Just as the sun illuminates the entire universe, the soul is illuminating the body. And you can focus on that. We call that noticing your life. Yeah. So we can actually, you know, spend more time noticing that than we do notice the thoughts that we're having, the dialogue that's going on up here. You know, because that dialogue has nothing to do with now, and it has nothing to do with the self. The self is directly experienced within the body as the life, as, you know, sensation of the body. But thoughts about, you know, your job, or thoughts about your health, or thoughts about the traffic or the weather has nothing to do with the self, has nothing to do with now. It's only something about the past or something about the future that has no substance and that ultimately will mean nothing. But it only means something because we give it meaning. But if, as soon as we notice that and we observe it without judgment, and we turn our attention back towards the experience of the self within the body and relish and appreciate that sense of aliveness, and then appreciate the source of that aliveness, that self, Krishna, when we chant his name, Hare Krishna. And as you're, you know, appreciating the joy of being, then there's relish, there's connection in that name beyond just a mental kind of vibration, you know, that, you know, it just becomes another thought with all our other thoughts. And then that creates like a wall of separation, hard to perceive really the name when we're identified with thought. But if we begin to disidentify with thought, then we chant the name with the awareness of our eternal presence, then there's that. Then the relationship's automatically there, beyond just some sentiment or wishful thinking, you know, or belief even.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. I wanted to ask a question related to the previous one, but a little bit more practical. So a pure devotee is not influenced by the modes of material nature because he's dissociated from the mind. He's at a higher awareness soul level, right? So pure devotees don't have this whole theater in the mind, and how can we get rid of it? Through japa, I've heard of a friend who went to Thailand for a silent retreat, and it was like a surgery of the mind. In 10 days, they were just silent the whole time, and she was observing her thoughts like clouds, and then towards the end, it was very, very painful, like physically even painful to go through this. And then at the end, they kind of had a debriefing and kind of put everything together again. So what would be an advice for a devotee who is practicing japa and who has this whole theater going on besides the holy name when they're chanting?
Thank you. I think what you were describing, your friend went through, is called the Vipassana. And that's a 10-day course. And my experience with that and with people who have gone through that is that they do have a certain awakening, but then they tend to fall back to sleep and they can't keep it up. As far as you said something that caught my attention. You said, "How can I get rid of it?" Right? How can I get rid of these thoughts? And that wanting to get rid of it, the resistance to what is there, causes it to stay there. So a lot of what we think about is what we're resisting in life, right? It's a lot of times, basically, the mind comes down to two things: what you want and what you don't want. We're thinking about what we want, and we're thinking about what we don't want. And whatever we want, we want to get, or we don't want to lose. And whatever, mostly, it's what we don't want. So it's kind of resistance. So That's like the glue that keeps the attention identified. So the first thing is to notice that resistance of wanting to get rid of it, wanting to get rid of the mind, wanting to get rid of the thoughts, and then to let that go, to observe that. You know, wherever you are, you take a step back and observe that. You know, you begin to witness that, and you let that be there, and then you're no longer it. So it is not the problem. You're the problem. So the mind is not the problem, and the thoughts in the mind are not the problem. It's our interest in the mind that's the problem. So wherever you're at, if you can take a step back from that and be the witnessing presence of that, then you're not feeding it, and it will just disappear because it has no substance anyway. It only has reality because of the energy, the life energy we're putting into it. That's why I'm suggesting that instead of investing the mind with our attention, we turn our attention back into the experience of our awareness within the body, because that will become energized and stronger. And because we're not putting that energy into the thoughts, they'll become weaker and the mind will become more quieter, and then that ability to sense presence will increase. And so Krishna also says this in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter. He says the mind is not the problem. The identification with the mind is what's the problem. And to resist that, we'll keep it going. So let's just look at that verse real quick. It's verse 271, chapter 271, I think. Can you read that verse out loud in English?
A person who has given up all desires for sense gratification, who lives free from desires, who has given up all sense of proprietorship, and is devoid of self-ego, he alone can attain real peace.
That's a nice verse, but it's not the verse I was looking for. I made a mistake. What? Can we read that? Right, it's just 270. It's just the one before it. Then we can look at 255.
A person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires.
See, do rivers ever stop flowing? No. So we all have impressions from this life, you know, from our childhood and up till now. And those impressions are always going to be flowing by. And so that's not the problem. The problem is our interest in those rivers. And so we just have to let them flow by and be the observer of them. Then we'll be like the ocean. Okay, so verse 255? 129? Oh, yeah, I love this verse.
That verse, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O Partha, when a man gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, which arise from mental concoction, and when his mind, thus purified, finds satisfaction in the self alone, then he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness.
Oh, nice. That's right on the mark.
And Krishna also in 245 is giving advice to Arjun, where the key advice is to become situated in the self. And this is on page 119. He's saying, the Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. O Arjun, become transcendental to these three modes. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self.
Aye. Atmavan. So how do we become established in the self?
Well, it would seem from the discussion we have had it would be the recommendation that you were giving is that we have to turn the conscious, we have to turn our attention to the consciousness within and be a witness to the activities of the mind and the thought.
Mm. And so it's not so hard, right? All we have to do is notice the feeling of aliveness in the body, which is, it's a direct perception, it's not a thought, and it doesn't require much effort. If we're a little distracted, it may require a little effort, but with a little practice, it becomes very easy. So right now, anyone can feel their hands, and it seems so simple that you're thinking, oh, this is bodily consciousness, but it's not. It's the awareness in the body, and there's no thought. And if you begin to do it, you'll notice it's very satisfying. You know, it's very peaceful. The sense of Satchitananda is there. If your awareness is just noticing the awareness, because there's no thought there, and there's this gap of no mind or no thought, and so then there's a little gap for the self to appear, and then you become established in the self, and you can do this while you're chanting. You know, you can be aware of your awareness in the body as you're chanting and appreciating that life and your relationship with Krishna, who's the source of that life. So it's a very, very easy way to stay focused during japa and out of the mind and just watching the mind. So when you notice all the thoughts going by, then you notice you're noticing, then you're out of it. Or you're in it. You're out of it, and then you're in it. Yes, Sunny.
Prabhuji, the way you are explaining, this is the realization. My question is there... This is the only way for that great realization, or any other way that we can achieve that realization?
There's no other way to become free of identification with the mind except by choosing to let it go, by observing it. And now, to make that realization more permanent, ultimately one needs to realize his relationship with Krishna. Like I was saying here, that in the beginning we're noticing what we're not, which is not the mind, but we're not really fixed. We're kind of, you know, we're not, until we're fixed at Krishna's lotus feet, we can easily become lost in that identification with the mind, because what we are hasn't become fully established. And what we are is Jiva Swarup Haya Krishna Nitya Das. We're the eternal servant of Krishna. So until we're firmly established in that, there's always a chance of becoming re-identified. So when you're understanding that you're not the mind and you're observing it, that's called Jiva Mukta. So that's the jiva liberated while he's in the body. But Mahaprabhu in the Bhagavatam also explains that one can easily fall down from that position. But ultimately, we have to be willing to let the illusion go and to focus on Krishna. We always have that choice. But of course, until somebody shows us how to do this, we don't really have much choice. Until we've heard about it through Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita and learn how to do it, then we're just, you know, basically fully under the control of the modes of nature. So once one has this information and begins to practice it, then we're exercising the will of the soul at that point, and we're choosing Krishna as opposed to Maya. But that we always have to, you know, ultimately we always have to choose to face, you know, to let go of the mind that we think is us and that we think is so important, and to choose Krishna. First, we have to choose ourself. So become established in the self, and then the source of that self. So there's so many different ways and processes, but ultimately bhakti is the easiest and it's the most efficacious, because it takes us to that fixed position at the lotus feet of Krishna, where the other paths, all the paths, you know, you have to control your senses, you have to control your mind, you have to realize the self. You know? But until you become established in your relationship with the super self, you're not really fully liberated. But we can take up bhakti, and as long as we chant with it and identify with the mind, then there's just going to be this veil between us and Krishna. And we'll be chanting and this get lost in the mind, and we won't feel the bliss of the self or the super self. And then you have a tendency to go back towards Maya. But ultimately, bhakti's the means, and it's the goal and the means. But we should do it with full attention, and we should direct the awareness towards the self and pull it out of the mind by observing the mind. As soon as you're, realize you're not present, then you're present again. So it's just continual, you know. Focus your attention on the holy name and the awareness, you know, the one who's chanting the name. And as soon as you observe that the attention has gone somewhere else, you pull it back. This is Krishna also explains in the sixth chapter, Abhyasa Yoga Yuktena. So by constant practice and detachment. So that detachment, every time you observe the thought and you recognize that you're the observer of the thought, that's detachment at its basic level. And that's where all attachment and detachment occur, is in that one point, that one space. And so chanting the holy name is the easiest and the most blissful and complete process of yoga in this age, and especially kirtan, which we're about to have with Artik, because it's very effortless compared to anything else. Oh, so we still have 5 minutes? Okay.
I can ask one, and that is, how would the process of meditation be different from chanting? There are different types of meditations that are around and recommended. Mm-hmm. How are they different from chanting Krishna's name?
Well, the difference between different processes of meditation are generally what the focus of attention is. And so, like I was mentioning to Sunny, or like in Zen, the focus of the attention is on the breath, generally. In Vipassana, it's just on observing the mind, becoming the witness. So the state of meditation is to awaken to the fact that you're the witness and not the mind. So that's the beginning state of meditation. But as we were suggesting before, that is not a fixed position for the jiva soul. The fixed position is to be jiva surupaya Krishna nitya das, to realize you're the eternal servant of God, the eternal servant of Krishna, or at least some form of God, whatever religion you know you're following. And that's fixed, and that's fully satisfying to the self. So therefore, the most comprehensive meditation is to meditate upon the holy name. It's the easiest, it's the most sublime, and it takes one to that fixed realization. But in the beginning, no matter what process you're following, you still have to have that direct experience of the self as different than the mind or the body. Otherwise, there's suffering and you're going to be lost in the mind no matter what you're doing. Of course, if you're doing bhakti yoga, then eventually you're going to come to the perfectional stage. And if you're doing some other process that has no bhakti in it and no conception of the Supreme Lord, then ultimately you might through lots of effort become jiva mukta in this life, but not attain liberation and then get sucked in again. So, but we can go on chanting for a long time and not have a direct experience of the self and still suffer due to our attachments and aversions in the mind until we begin to direct our attention towards the self and the relationship with the Lord. Even if we're doing this process, it can still remain very, very external. And we can maintain all our material conditionings, all our attachments, all our addictions, and all our misconceptions about ourselves. We can keep that going as long as we want. But by the process of chanting, by the association, by hearing Bhagavad Gita, each time, you know, another peel of the onion is taken off. And eventually there'll just be a full awakening. But we don't want to be like the elephant if we can avoid it, where the elephant goes and takes a bath and gets all clear and pure and then goes out onto the shore and rolls in the dust again. So we tend to do that by staying identified with our mind and maintaining the same illusions. We energize it with our attention.
Prabhupada, he mentioned that when electricity is passed through a wire, it gets energized. Similarly, when we chant, we get spiritualized. How can we use that concept in chanting? Can we use that concept?
It's just like when you chant, it's like taking a bath, right? So when we chant, when our attention is on the mantra, then the mantra has filled the mind space. And the mantra is full of light. Krishna, his body is full of light. He's supremely pure. He's antiseptic. He's got no veins. And then we're in a purified state. You know? Then we stop chanting. And whatever thoughts we were thinking before, those thoughts come in and we think, oh, that's me. And then it's like, that's like rolling in the dirt again. So the more or we could be chanting the holy name, but while we're chanting, we're allowing all those other thoughts in the mind space. So our attention is really on the thoughts, it's not on the holy name. So then the effect is much, much less. See? But when we chant with full attention and with devotion, then at that point, we're actually, we're in a purified state. And the more we maintain that, the more and more we get freed of the mind and freed of identification. Or, you know, we're hooked up with the electricity.
Thank you, Satyadeva Prabhu.
Thank you.